funding for NJ Spotlight News provided by the members of the New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child, and RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, one-on-one with U.S. Senate candidate Andy Kim after his day in federal court trying to abolish the county line ballot system.
We're the outlier, and we do it in a way that allows party leaders to give preferential placement to their preferred candidates, and that's just not fair.
Plus, making their voices heard during the first public budget hearing in Newark. And no surprise, everyone's asking for more money.
To the Walmarts, the Amazons, and the Wells Fargos, it's time to pay your fair share.
Also, gun permits surging here in the Garden State, nearly 2 years after the Supreme Court struck down some of the toughest gun law restrictions.
Gun violence rates would go up as well, and that's not me saying firearms are bad, but it's saying where there's more firearms, there's more gun violence.
And if you're looking to buy or sell a home, major changes are coming to the way agents can broker their commission fees. NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Venosi.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us this Tuesday night. I'm Brianna Venosi. New Jersey's county party bosses are potentially on the verge of a massive shift to their power after a marathon hearing on Monday in a federal courtroom in Trenton over the constitutionality of the state's ballot design, more often referred to as the party line system. During 9 hours of oral arguments, lawyers representing Congressman Andy Kim, who brought the lawsuit, and others in support of ending the line, argued it goes against the pursuit of democracy because it gives an unfair advantage to those who are awarded the line, and prospective candidates have dropped their election bids in the past if they didn't secure the endorsement. Kim is locked in a heated primary race against First Lady Tammy Murphy for the U.S. Senate seat currently occupied by embattled senior senator Bob Menendez. Attorneys for the defendants, which are the 19 counties that use this ballot structure, argued it's just not feasible to change how candidates are grouped on a ballot design before the June election. The court hearing took place as Murphy nabbed her eighth organization line from Gloucester County Democrats, though it may not matter much after the judge issues a ruling. I'm joined now by the man at the center of this lawsuit, Representative Andy Kim. Congressman, thanks for giving us a few minutes of your time today. A whirlwind 24 hours, if I may say that. A marathon hearing yesterday. Did you get any indication from the judge how he's leaning after the testimony?
Thank you for having me. No indication. He was somebody who was very clear. He wanted to be fair about this and really have a structured process. But I do appreciate the ability for us to be able to make our case and be able to talk about why we think this is unfair and why we think this is unconstitutional. And I was really proud of our team in terms of what we were able to put forward.
You spoke for about an hour, as I understand it. What was the crux of the argument you presented personally?
Well, the crux of the argument is that, you know, this is a system unlike any other system in the United States. 49 other states in America use an office block ballot, a very standard ballot for our elections. New Jersey does not. We're the outlier, and we do it in a way that allows party leaders to give preferential placement to their preferred candidates, and that's just not fair. You know, organizations, the parties, they can endorse candidates as they would like, but just, you know, don't structure that in terms of a ballot line for the elections. And, you know, that's what's causing this to be unfair, and that's what we're asking to change.
The defendant's argument about the timing of this and getting this all done in time for the primary was the main point that they made. Do you see a clear path to victory if you don't win this case?
Well, first thing I want to just say is, it should be noted how they're really not making an argument countering what I said about the unfairness of this process. And, you know, I think that that's something that we really need to know, because, you know, it just, what was their actual argument on that front? And so if it's about viability of what we can get done, you know, we feel like we presented that expertise as well to show it can be done in time. But look, regardless, I will be on the ballot on June 4th, and I believe that I have a very strong path to victory no matter what happens in the courtroom. And, you know, I'm going to continue to push on as hard as I can.
What was your reaction, Congressman, to the Attorney General's decision to weigh in at the 11th hour, and how much weight do you think it'll have on this case?
I'm not sure, you know, what weight it'll have, but certainly, you know, for me as a resident of New Jersey, it was powerful to hear our chief law enforcement officer of the state give that strong of an opinion about what he assesses. You know, this is someone that, you know, is in the highest leadership positions when it comes to these types of issues. And I think that certainly it's causing New Jerseyans to take note. How it impacts the court, I do not know. But it was a very important and very courageous step forward.
Either way, whichever way this case goes, it seems at least as though this is going to reshape politics. Do you think this has created an inflection point for Democrats?
Well, I think the inflection point has already happened. You know, like I really do believe that Jersey politics has already changed. And it's just a matter of whether or not the political leadership in this state realize it. But, you know, between the indictment of the senator and then this Senate primary and what's happening with this attention to the ballots and what we've seen in the reaction for the public about transparency and Oprah, I mean, like, we're seeing a change already happening. So, you know, I really do think Jersey politics will be different and it'll be changed going forward.
Win or lose, you see things being different moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said, I think it's already changed. And I'm hoping that we can keep that change going and have it happen fast, because the people are demanding it. You know, you see that. I mean, you see that in, you know, my 85-point win in Morris County, a 76-point win in Atlantic County at these conventions. You know, people are ready for a change in New Jersey.
Congressman Andy Kim, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
A raucous group of activists made sure their concerns were known at the first public hearing on Governor Murphy's proposed fiscal year 2025 budget, calling on the governor to restore a full corporate business tax surcharge that expired at the end of the year, and accusing the administration of balancing the budget on the backs of hardworking residents. Senior correspondent Joanna Gagas was there.
Hoping their voices would carry inside, these advocacy groups rallied on the campus of NJIT this morning, just outside of the room where the Senate Budget Committee was holding a public hearing on the governor's proposed fiscal year 25 budget.
To the Walmarts, the Amazons, and the Wells Fargos, it's time to pay your fair share.
They're calling on Governor Murphy and the legislature to fully restore the corporate business tax surcharge that expired in December, saying the governor's newly proposed corporate transit fee doesn't go far enough to tax wealthy businesses, given the proposed increase to NJ Transit fares.
Pero las tarifas del bus están.
Bus fares are still going up, and the senior pass is still going to be cut. I really don't know how I'm going to pay for the increased prices.
The budget cannot be balanced on the backs of Black and Brown New Jersey communities.
Inside the hearing, members of the business community pushed back on the governor's corporate transit fee, saying he's trying to close NJ Transit budget holes on the backs of businesses.
The corporate transit fee is just another name, as we know, for the corporate business tax that just sunset. It just sunset 11 weeks ago. Those companies were banking on getting that money back to commit into their workforce, their facilities, and their communities.
They're not the only ones asking for funding to be restored. Education's a big one we heard today, with school districts asking for their funds to be restored and community colleges asking for their cuts to be reversed.
For many, community college is the only affordable way to attain a quality undergraduate education, and this budget hinders that vital opportunity. I'm here today to ask you to restore the 12% cut in funding in the proposed budget and further build upon last year's historic pledge with an increase in funding.
Losing that $20 million is a hard, hard hit across our system, and would be a very devastating hit to our colleges and, frankly, to our students as well.
We see advocacy groups calling on the governor to restore the corporate business tax. Do you support that as a way to kind of claw some of this money back for county colleges?
We don't think that's necessary. We think that there is already money there without putting new taxes. You know, we really go hand in hand with business. We are training their future employees. We rely on them as well. They are too one of those lifebloods of New Jersey. So we believe the money is there. There's not a need for greater taxation.
And school districts that lost millions in this final phase-in of the S2 funding formula pleaded for a plan to restore their cuts.
The S2 reduction this year was supposed to be $337,000. So you can imagine our shock and our horror when that $337,000 turned into $4.69 million.
South Brunswick, as of right now, is operating 6 years later with $30 million less money. Going forward, please, we need, and I say this bipartisan. This is not a partisan. Kids are not partisan. Kids are not red and blue.
We're seeing districts lose 15%, 16% of their state aid when they were expecting a much smaller number. We've got to look at some short-term supports, but we also do need to look at some longer-term supports. So we're also asking them to put $2 million towards a task force that can really look at the formula.
Education funding seemed to stir support from legislators on both sides of the aisle who, at least today, voiced their support for restoring both county college funding and coming up with temporary funding relief for districts before this budget season ends. In Newark, I'm Joanna Gagas, NJ Spotlight News.
It's been nearly 2 years since a U.S. Supreme Court ruling made it easier for people around the country to carry guns in public. And state officials say New Jersey is already feeling those effects. That ruling, known as the Bruin decision, said Americans have a right to carry a firearm outside the home for self-defense purposes, undercutting laws in states like New Jersey that required a person to show a justifiable need. Since then, we've learned tens of thousands of people in the Garden State have taken advantage. Ted Goldberg reports.
Since the Bruin decision, state data says more than 30,000 New Jerseyans have applied for a concealed carry permit.
We actually thought the numbers would be higher. You know, you have, what, in excess of 8 million people in the state of New Jersey, and the estimate's over a million, gun owners.
RTSP has trained 5,000 of them at their two locations. Co-owner Rick Friedman says training for a concealed carry permit is much different than just shooting at a range.
We want people to get proficient in the actual drawing of the firearm, how you're going to engage a target. Then we bring them on the range for their actual qualification, and we have to deem them proficient. And that's everything. That's not just the rounds on the paper. That's how they draw, how they go in and out of the holster, and how safe they are.
Before the Bruin decision, New Jerseyans had to meet the legal standard of a justifiable need to concealed carry. You can see the difference in concealed carry applications in the 20 months pre-Bruin and post-Bruin in New Jersey, about 1,100 versus 33,000. That has gun control advocates afraid of what might happen next.
We know that that's something that's not going to make people safer, but the gun industry has been pushing the message that it will.
David Pacino is the legal director and deputy chief counsel for the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He's worried that more guns in public will lead to more crime.
Interpersonal conflicts that might have been either angry words or maybe a fist fight will escalate into fatal violence. We know that that will happen more. We know that people who are carrying guns are more likely to seek out or find themselves in situations where violence results.
As firearm access rates go up in New Jersey, just as you've seen universally across all other instances, gun violence rates would go up as well. And that's not me saying firearms are bad, but it's saying where there's more firearms, there's more gun violence.
Mike Anestis leads the New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center at Rutgers. He says other states saw an increase in gun violence when they loosened carry and permit laws. That hasn't happened in New Jersey yet. The state says 924 people were shot last year, the lowest figure in at least 15 years.
The impacts were more profound than they would have been in a spot like New Jersey, which has been much more sort of forward-thinking and data-driven in how we think about firearm access and the ability for folks to carry in public spaces.
Legally purchased weapons are not used for the most part in crime in New Jersey. Our crime weapons, based upon our data and our analysis, show, and you've heard us say it, that 80% of our crime guns are from outside the state of New Jersey.
Colonel Patrick Callahan with the state police also says there hasn't been a drastic bump in public shootings or people accidentally shooting their guns.
I think responsible gun owners that follow those procedures that go and get their background checks and have that process done and apply for a permit to carry are just that.
People that tend to go through the process and carry are actually very safe. They understand that they're carrying a firearm. They understand the responsibility behind it.
In the wake of the Bruin decision, Attorney General Matt Plackin has sued to uphold state laws banning guns in so-called sensitive places. His office argued in appeals court in Philadelphia this past October, but that lawsuit is ongoing, just like the battle over concealed carry in New Jersey. In Union, I'm Ted Goldberg, NJ Spotlight News.
Fort Lee is the latest school district in the state to grapple with the gender identity policy known as 5756, which addresses the rights of transgender students. The policy was enacted in 2017 and informed schools they weren't required to notify parents of their child's gender identity. After going back and forth about voting to rescind the policy, the Fort Lee Board of Education last night decided, ultimately, to keep it in place. The decision came after hours of testimony from more than 50 speakers. They included trans students who spoke about what the guidelines have meant for them personally. Critics have said the 5756 policy infringes on parental rights, but advocates, which last night included students who are not yet out but submitted letters, say it has, in some cases, saved their lives. Despite the number of clinical trials available in the U.S., research shows women are often left out or underrepresented. That's critical for individuals diagnosed with rare diseases because those trials are frequently their only avenue for care. Rare medical disorders have few FDA-approved treatments. Congressman Josh Gottheimer today announced new federal legislation to both boost pipelines for clinical trials and help find cures for the rare illnesses that disproportionately affect women. Melissa Rose Cooper reports.
As a member of the Rare Disease Caucus in Congress, I couldn't agree more with the agenda here that we have to achieve as a country, making sure that we invest more in women's health care. It's an area that has too often actually been left behind, where we haven't invested enough, where we haven't done enough, and it's part of why we're here this morning.
Congressman Josh Gottheimer joining doctors, nurses, and other health advocates at Cooperman Barnabas Medical Center to announce his latest initiative to support women. The SEARCH Act, which stands for Securing Equal Access to Research, Care, and Health, aims to fund treatment for rare diseases that disproportionately impact women. The congressman says the legislation will tackle various research challenges, including poor participation in clinical trials.
Since 94, fewer than 4% of adults in the United States participated in clinical trials, despite prolonged recruitment efforts. We try to find people, and people just don't raise their hand. What's worse, up to 85% of clinical trials fail to recruit or retain a sufficient sample size. So that leads to failures to meet targets in 4 out of every 5 trials.
And for rare diseases, which impact less than 200,000 people and don't often have FDA-approved treatments, doctors say it's even harder to maintain proper trials.
Not uncommonly, due to the limited understanding of these diseases and the small number of people affected, funding for research is often scarce, making it difficult to find treatments. For the individual or family with the disease, getting to a diagnosis may be a long and frustrating road fraught with prolonged suffering, misdiagnosis, and treatment delays.
I have witnessed the disparities women face and have faced for decades. Women are overlooked, misdiagnosed, or not diagnosed at all, and it has become clear that legislation of this kind is not only necessary, but critical for women not only with bleeding disorders, but also for women in the rare disease community at large.
Suzanne Spronell knows all too well the negative impact not having access to treatment can have. She lost a 30-year-old niece in 2020 who had been battling a rare disease since she was a child.
Just last year, 24 years after she was initially diagnosed, and almost 3 years to the day after she died, the FDA approved a new medication to slow the progression for Friedreich's ataxia. A breakthrough that arrived too late for my niece, but marked a significant step forward for others.
While the congressman says there has been some progress over the years, he says more work still needs to be done.
95% of more than 10,000 rare diseases that impact more than 30 million Americans have no FDA-approved treatment, right? It's a lot of people. These rare diseases affect small amounts of people, right? But you add them all up, it's lots and lots of people and a lot of families who are affected. Rare disease research is critical. Not only can it lead to a cure or treatment for those afflicted by that disease, but the research can also be a gateway to breakthroughs for other treatments and cures.
Goals health advocates hope this new legislation will achieve so more lives can be saved. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Melissa Rose Cooper.
In our Spotlight on Business report, a major shakeup in the housing market. Real estate commission rules are about to change, shifting that 6% fee paid to realtors when buying or selling a home to just a fraction of that. It comes after the National Association of Realtors agreed to pay a landmark $418 million to settle lawsuits from home sellers who argued commissions were inflated. Critics also said the longstanding policy helped drive home prices higher. But what will it mean for the pockets of those looking to buy or sell a property in the state? Gloria Monks is the president of New Jersey Realtors and recently joined me to talk about the change. Gloria, thanks so much for your time today. I'd like to first just get your reaction to this settlement and what it'll mean for home buyers.
So the settlement right now is a proposed settlement. It has not been signed off on. We expect it to be potentially signed off on within the next few months. And the changes that they are talking about will take effect sometime in July. So right now, I don't see many changes happening with regard to the market. Commissions have never been fixed. It's always been very negotiable. It's between the listing agent and the seller.
What will this mean, though? Is it the end of this, this 6% rate that a lot of us are talking about? I know you say it's not fixed, but that is generally the number that these deals are based around. Does it spell the end for that?
Well, as far as commission rates, I haven't really seen any particular numbers. That it's always been a conversation between sellers and the listing agents. So we haven't had any fixed number, that it's just a matter of how the conversation will be with regard to the listing agent talking with the seller. As we know, first-time home buyers don't have a lot of excess cash to pay broker commissions. And so, we just have to wait and see how this pans out once the settlement is signed and everything is done. It is something that I don't want to speculate and say that prices are going to drop. Our inventory is very, very low. As of right now, we only have two in Mercer County, which is where my market is. It's 2.5 months worth of inventory. A healthy market would be around 6 months. So with the scarcity of inventory, prices will remain high. I mean, we just don't know what's going to happen here. So again, as far as, how it will help first-time home buyers would be pure speculation.
What are you hearing, Gloria, from your members, from fellow realtors? Because ostensibly, this could be less money in their pockets.
Right now, I think they are continuing to do business the way they've done it in the past, and that is negotiating commissions, what works best for the sellers when they talk with the sellers about what the commission rate will be when they list the property. The difference will be in how things are put into the MLS. And so not having commissions in the MLS will start the conversation for buyers to have with their buyer's agents. They'll be able to talk with the seller's agents to talk with the sellers about what the commissions will be. How this all shakes out is, it's never happened before, so we really can't say.
Yeah, a lot to be seen. Gloria Monks is the president of New Jersey Realtors. Gloria, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brianna. Thanks for having me.
On Wall Street, stocks were mixed amid a looming decision from the Fed on interest rates. Here's how the markets closed today.
Support for the Business Report provided by the New Jersey Chamber of Commerce, announcing its ReNew Jersey Business Summit and Expo, March 26th and 27th at Harrah's in Atlantic City. Event details online at njchamber.com.
That's going to do it for us tonight, but make sure you check out the latest episode of Off Exit. It's our new podcast that journeys across the state to share unique slice of life stories from New Jerseyans. In this episode, NJ Spotlight News producer and host of the show, Harrison Malkin, introduces us to Teaneck Kaylin Cardello. He's a rising jazz star. Cardello is a William Patterson University and Jazz House Kids alumnus, and when he's not performing in New York City, he plays regularly in the church band in Wayne, New Jersey. You can download Off Exit wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Brianna Venosi for the entire NJ Spotlight News team. Thanks for being with us. Have a great evening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years. And by the PSCG Foundation.
Have some water.
Look at these kids.
How are you?
What do you see? I see myself. I became an ESL teacher to give my students what I wanted when I came to this country. The opportunity to learn, to dream, to achieve, a chance to belong and to be an American. My name is Julia Toriani Crompton, and I'm proud to be an NJEA member.